Hi, everybody. This is Micha Sifri from Personal Democracy Media, and welcome to another of our ongoing series of Personal Democracy Plus conference calls with movers, shakers, thinkers, doers, and innovators at the intersection of technology, politics, government, and civil society. This week, we are going to be talking with Andrew Slack, the founder of the Harry Potter Alliance, a man who refers to himself as a practitioner of cultural acupuncture. That is, he looks for the places in the culture where you can stick a needle, if you will, and release some energy. What we're going to be focusing on with him is a very interesting process, which he's got some experience with now, not just from the Harry Potter world, but also from other cultural phenomena like the Hunger Games, where a book or a movie inspires so many fans that many of these people actually decide to band together and take their passion for the story or passion for a character and move into the real world as activists trying to make a difference, trying to make the world a better place. And without any further ado, let's dive in. Andrew, welcome. You know, and why don't you start out, take a couple minutes and you know, talk to us about how you know, how you got into this in the first place, and how did the Harry Potter Alliance, for starters, get launched?
Sure. Great. Well, thank you, Micha. It's great to be here, and thanks to all of your listeners. And I have been a fan of Personal Democracy Media and Personal Democracy. I mean, everything with the word Personal Democracy that you've been putting together for since I've known you since 2006. So it's a real pleasure to be here today. So where I got started with Harry Potter was in 2002. The Harry Potter phenomenon was already a big deal. I was 23 years old. I had just graduated from college. I had no interest in reading the books outside of one of my mentors who I was a TA for. His name's Maury Stein. He was one of the close friends to Maury Schwartz from Tuesdays with Maury. And he once discussed that Harry Potter is one of the best things that our culture offers children. And his class was that I TA'd for was very much around the power of the mythological story as well as the collective story being something that can shape our world and renew our world and renew each other to create both personal and social transformation. I had a lot of background such as around storytelling going into college and throughout college, studying acting at a conservatory in London, working with peace workers in Northern Ireland from various countries and doing quantitative analysis of American social movements going up and down the East Coast of the U.S. and learning from so many civil rights workers that it really came down to how they told the story of the civil rights movement. So I, as an actor and as a comedian and as someone interested in social change, I did want to blend those things together and create something to use the power of story for social change, for changing the story of our world. I was pretty skeptical about Harry Potter. It sounded like a fad to me, and a passing one. But I had a day job teaching at the Boys and Girls Club in Cambridge. I had just come from another day job teaching at an affluent creative arts theater camp, and I just couldn't believe how so many kids lit up when they talked about Harry Potter. So I finally decided to give it a chance on Halloween in 2002. I picked up the first book. And I read the first chapter of that first book. And Micha, have you read the books out of curiosity?
I have read them, and I should say that my kids, who are now 22 and almost 19, got to read them as they came out. In other words, instead of devouring all seven in a weekend, which I know some people have been known to do, they had to wait for each new one to come out, and in some ways it tracked their own, development from being, relatively young children to young adults. And they both refer to that as a special experience that they were able to have, to, if you will, grow up with Harry Potter.
Absolutely.
So, yeah,
and it's,
I'm fully aware of the story.
So you know it well. Okay, that's were you one of the families that had to buy more than one copy? Because otherwise
there
would be fighting? Okay, yeah.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
a whole phenomenon,
oh, yeah.
too. A lot of families own more than...
We had to ship copies to them at camp also. When they tended to come out in July, if I remember correctly, some of them came out then.
Most of them came out in the summer. Yeah. Well, I by the time that I got into it, four of them had already come out. There were three still on their way, and I read this first book. I read the first chapter of the first book, and this feeling that I can't explain. It only happened once before when I was 16, reading Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse. This feeling just shot through me. I turned to the person sitting next to me and I said, this book just changed my life. It really felt like it had. And I became obsessed with Harry Potter. It took me to a lot of what I was looking for as just coming out of college and missing a campus. I found the magic of that experience of Hogwarts, the wish to go back to a campus. I found that in Harry Potter. It was a very intensely personal experience for me that related to so much of me and so much of how I looked at the world. And really took me to this childlike place where I used to, I spent my entire early formative childhood watching The Wizard of Oz and other stories of my mom, and Harry Potter really struck that chord for me. I oftentimes bring up how at that time I had a girlfriend who, I just was so excited when she would fall asleep so that I could read Harry Potter, or the post office became the most exciting place in the world because the lines gave me the opportunity to read Harry Potter. I think I was a hazard to myself and to others because I walked down the street just reading the books, plowing through those first couple months to get done all four books. And I would just talk about it again and again, and then I began seeing these parallels in the books, not only to my own life, but also to our world. And that Rowling had worked for Amnesty International, and it was very clear that there were so many parallels in the books. You know, Harry's godfather is innocent of all crimes, but in an age of terrorism where it looked like he was guilty, habeas corpus had been suspended, he was thrown into a prison, and he was tortured, which was standard practice in that world. And there's a whole slew of things around house elves and fair wages, as well as the equal treatment to people who are not from wizarding families in the wizarding world, but are still wizards nonetheless, and how they're treated through discrimination, racial discrimination, as well as other creatures in the wizarding world, centaurs and half-giants and werewolves. She's really introducing people, I was seeing, to this whole array of social justice topics allegorically and in a very powerful story that is, goes far beyond allegory, I should say, and to the roots of some of our greatest myths. But to continue, when I got the fifth book, I was amazed that Harry has to start a student activist group named after his mentor, Dumbledore, Dumbledore's Army. And I began thinking, what if all of these people, because I soon, you know, came to understand that there were people besides me that were having these intense experiences with Harry Potter. You know, this was a huge phenomenon. I wasn't one of the people that was going onto websites at that point and engaging in the fandom. I was a private Harry Potter fan who would tell all my friends. I was very annoying to them. They hadn't read it yet. But I was an evangelist at that time, trying to get them all into it. And eventually I succeeded with most of them, I'd say. So that was then. And as I began talking about that and this idea of a Dumbledore's Army for our world, Mika, we were introduced by my very old friend, Justin Oberman, who he just sort of flipped out and said, well, yeah, I need to create a blog for you. And he created a blog for me, and he urged me to write about Harry Potter, which I did, and to get to know the fandom. So I began looking at the fandom, and I began asking the fandom questions around, well, you know, if Harry Potter were in our world, wouldn't he do more than just talk about Harry Potter? Wouldn't he fight for justice in our world the way he fought for justice in his? And, you know, I got a tepid response, I'd say. But then I met the band
Let me stop it. Let me just stop you. Once, when you say the fandom, what do you mean by that? I mean, is there a specific place where all the Harry Potter fans were hanging out that you know?
Yep.
I haven't noticed a club downtown for that. So where was this dialogue happening?
Well, there were a tremendous amount of websites at that time. They have since changed, but the main ones then are still the main ones now. Websites like MuggleNet.com, The Leaky Cauldron, which now you can find at LeakyNews.com. And you're looking at over 100,000 unique visitors a day on MuggleNet.com, which started by a 12-year-old. But the time that I got involved, you know, he was probably about 17.
It's
now
it still
20.
Gets around 100,000 a month from what I'm seeing.
I mean, at the time it was like 100. I mean, it was a day over 100,000. I mean, what, right now what it gets, I'm not entirely sure what their metrics are.
Still,
but
it's still substantial, though. Yeah.
It's still huge. It's still gigantic, and it's and I think one of the successes, one of our board members, Melissa Anelli, who's the head of the Leaky Cauldron and Leaky Inc., she is a best-selling author of Harry, A History, which is a history of the Harry Potter fandom, where she writes a lot about the fact that Web 2.0 was happening, coming out at the same time as each of these books, and that the very kids that were waiting for each of these books had all of this time to talk about the books, create their own websites. It was the perfect storm, and it allowed Harry Potter to be the phenomenon that it is. And I think that this is a very important point here, is that Harry Potter changed young adult literature in a very permanent way, because it was hogging up the New York Times best-selling list, and a lot of adult authors were annoyed. The New York Times responded by creating a young adult list specifically, so creating another New York Times best-selling list for children and adult and young adult literature. Well, it opened up the entire industry at that point. It made room for Twilight and The Hunger Games and whatever is to come next, but also for the burgeoning careers of so many YA authors that never would have been paid attention to. This opening up of kids using Web 2.0 through Harry Potter got them involved in other YA experiences, and it's made YA one of the most lucrative things that still exists in the publishing industry, possibly the fastest growing part of the publishing industry. Well, so much of it is dwindling, obviously. So that's a crucial point to see the history of Web 2.0, how it intersects with Harry Potter, and how that ended up blowing up all of young adult literature and changing the way we tell stories just through books. This band, Harry and the Potters, they loved it. And to speak also to your question there, I was a Harry Potter fan. I understood the books front to back. I read them religiously. And yet I wasn't part of the fandom. And there's a difference. The fandom is when you congregate with other fans in one place. It could be in your city. It could be in your neighborhood. It could be just with your friends and you form a little fan community. But when you hook it into the entire world through the internet, you end up, I call it ETR, energy, talent, and resources. You see the amount of energy, talent, and resources that is going in here. It is unbelievable. We have the International Quidditch Association is one of the fastest growing things I've ever seen, and they actually have a shot at becoming an Olympic sport, which is a crazy thing to think about, but it is a very sophisticated sport that's like lacrosse meets rugby meets running around with broomsticks. There's Wizard Rock. And Wizard Rock was started by Harry and the Potters, and they're two brothers who look like Harry Potter, dress like Harry Potter, and sing songs from Harry's perspective. And there's all these different conferences and fan fiction websites. I mean, it's such a rich culture where kids were learning how to write songs, imitating Harry and the Potters. Hundreds of bands were formed in Wizard Rock. So there was all of this, and posing this question, would Harry fight for justice in our world? And the resounding answer was yes. Once Harry and the Potters got involved, and they're a punk rock band, they were very interested in doing social justice work, and they took the action alerts that I wrote about really getting into the symbolism of Harry Potter and into the symbolism of Dumbledore's army, connecting it to our world, and then showing things we can do by partnering with certain NGOs and their actions, their actionable steps. And they would repost it, and they reposted it to their 50 or 60,000 friends at the time on MySpace. That blew up over the next couple of years to near 100,000. And then all of these bands started reposting, following suit from Harry and the Potters. Bands like the Moaning Myrtles, the Whomping Willows, Draco and the Malfoys, which is the enemy band to Harry and the Potters, who sing songs like, "My dad is rich and your dad is dead. My dad is rich and your dad is dead." And yet they would still be, even though they're cruel and sadistic, they were still for social justice and came up with weird rationalizations as to why they supported the Harry Potter lines. So this whole community, Wizard Rock, was doing it. And so the biggest fan sites, the Leaky Cauldron, MuggleNet, they all got involved. Soon we were an international organization so fast within the first repost of Harry and the Potters, actually. And soon our campaigns were advancing. We were building a staff. J.K. Rowling had mentioned us in Time magazine because she was so stunned at what we had done. And now we're at a point where we can look back and see that we're really using the parallels of Harry Potter to inspire a network that now goes beyond even the Harry Potter fandom into other fandoms, into YouTube communities that reaches over a million people to encourage them and inspire them to become heroes in our world. We've sent 5 cargo planes to Haiti and to different Harry Potter characters. We've built libraries across the world, and we're building a digital system to have these libraries interact with each other and do projects together based on the books they love, but to have them civically engaged. And we've done a lot of advocacy on issues around human rights, around equality. We're right now in a somewhat contentious campaign, unfortunately, with the parent company to Harry Potter, Warner Brothers, to make all Harry Potter chocolate fair trade. That's created a whole interesting set of corporate transparency questions based on they're not showing us some information that they should be showing us. And I can get into that if there's time. We've been covered by just about every major media publication in the United States, almost everyone. And this gets into how Henry Jenkins, the media scholar Henry Jenkins, has called us a premier model for civic engagement in the 21st century, and that we're really reinventing the way activism can be done. It doesn't have to all be totally serious, that there's a sense of playfulness in activism, and that, you know, ultimately I've been saying lately, I don't think I'm here to save the world or that we're here to save the world, but I do think we're here to fall in love with the world. And in Harry Potter, that message of love being the most important thing, and we say the weapon we have is love. So that's where I can stop, except to say that I think that we continue to show people through our actions and deeds that when your kids are out there reading books, it doesn't have to just be an escape. Fantasy does not necessarily mean it's an escape from our world, but an invitation to go deeper into it. And we're creating that space for that to happen.
Yeah. Well, you've given me plenty to chew on. Let me just start by asking a little bit more about the nuts and bolts of the Harry Potter Alliance. So it started as a blog, and, you know, you kind of caught a wave and became a focal point for a lot of these fan communities. So I'm curious, you know, if you could just take us a little bit more into the nuts and bolts of organizing this. I mean, I know, you know, you, at least for some period, have gotten a salary from it, but for the most part, it's completely run by volunteers. How do you guys even decide what you're going to focus on? The fact that you have positions on things like fair trade, for example, you know, suggests that somewhere, you know, the Alliance, you know, which has all these grassroots chapters, is doing more than just saying, let's donate books to library. You know, let's not just pick the obvious, easy, sort of apolitical charity kinds of things to do. So you've got to tell us a little bit more how it went from being this personal passion, you saw a way, you know, to sort of move the sort of morality of Harry Potter, Dumbledore's army, all these things. I agree with you. There's absolutely a good versus evil. And, you know, if good people don't band together, evil will triumph kind of theme that's really resonant in the stories. But converting that into a real-world activist network is, you know, it's not obvious how one does that. So to take us more into the detail of it, and also, you know, given that it's all virtual, right? I mean, you're riding the Web 2.0 wave, and, you know, you, Andrew, I would describe you, you know, we use this term network weaver, you know, people who lead not by exhorting other people to do things, but by example. But tell us more about how you actually, you know, kind of built the Harry Potter Alliance, and, you know, what advice, you know, what lessons you would share about how one goes about doing that.
Sure. And this is always, you know, I am such a, I have that preacher mentality. So I always talk about the why, and I get so passionate. I sometimes do and I'm oftentimes surrounded by people who do I want to push back on me to make me more practical.
Mm-hmm.
So please do correct me when I'm not giving you enough of the nuts and bolts, because I need to get better at this part of the explanation of what we do, because there's a lot of nuts and there's a lot of bolts. But just to make one point clear, I don't want there to be any miscommunication here. We do have 70 volunteers that we've built since 2008. They clock in about 1,500 hours per week of volunteer work. We have close to 100 chapters who do our offline stuff. But I and two other people are full-time employees of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been the case for a number of years. So don't think of me too much of a thing. This is now my job. But the people, the countless people that are volunteers, are doing this out of the goodness of their heart. And I would like to think I do this out of the goodness of my heart as well. But it has definitely, through the fan community, which is constantly doing charitable efforts, we've managed to be able to turn this into a viable 501c3 nonprofit, which is not to scale. Now we're close to scale, but I hope it doesn't disappoint you at all in hearing that.
No, that's important news, and let's be practical. Most things, even volunteer-driven organizations, to grow to some scale usually involves some paid staff. People join as volunteers. I assume they're paying dues voluntarily. This isn't like a requirement, right?
No, not a requirement at all. Not at all. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of the bands that raise money for us. A lot of conferences do, as well as we won the Chase Bank Community Giving Challenge, and we were number one out of 10,000 organizations that were vying for that spot. When we were winning, actually, a lot of nonprofits were saying this is very unfair. I mean, all they're doing is getting Harry Potter kids involved, and that's sort of the model. I mean, that's why I'd argue what we do works. And to get money in the beginning from foundations and to have them take us seriously was a difficult thing, because it sounds like a crazy idea, and in essence, it is a crazy idea. But most great ideas start off sounding pretty crazy, and it's a matter of then building that proof of concept to show the world that this crazy thing is actually quite sane and maybe still a little crazy. So what we've, in terms of picking these things, we have a very active board, which I am on, and we started off the organization. We are nonpartisan, but we are unapologetically progressive. And we didn't want to just be a fan club for good. We didn't want to just go out there and just do nice things for people. That is, for those people who are Harry Potter fans, that would be Hufflepuff organization. And we have that Hufflepuff mentality for sure. And we have many proud Hufflepuffs in our organization. But there also is that taking a brave stance for justice, which some of my Hufflepuff friends will be offended if I don't correct and say that they also take brave stance for justice. The politics of fandom is a fascinating thing. It's just like politics, except there's more metaphors.
Sounds like it's more fun, too.
It's a lot more fun. It's a lot more fun, yeah. to return to this, though, one of the basic tensions of working with an organization that is working with people on a wide array of issues, and it's their first time ever, really, for the most part, their first time ever getting involved in social justice issues, is that the first thing most of us want to do when we get involved in civic engagement is to do something where we can see the difference we're making. That would include donating books, painting somebody's house, or doing practical acts of good deeds and loving good deeds of service. And this is a really important thing. I don't think that there's any way that I could condescend to charity and to service. Where that's problematic is if it compromises some of the other stuff. We're an organization that tries to work on both of those things. So we have campaigns such as the book drive we do, Akio Books, with Akio being the summoning charm. And that was a calculated decision. We hadn't had anything like that. And me and Paul George from Harry the Potters had a conversation about this. We kind of said, our membership and the whole Harry Potter fandom continues to love us, and yet they organize their own book drives. we don't want to organize book drives because we don't feel like putting our energy in that place. We want to create systematic political change. But that's what we want. Let's actually listen to our members. And Akio Books was absolutely one of our most powerful things that we had done at that point. And it also allowed our advocacy drives to become all the more powerful, too. And our advocacy stuff has included having Wizard Rock bands create original songs about media consolidation in the United States, and then tying that to media consolidation in the wizarding world, tying that to media consolidation in the United States, and then easy ways that people can get involved in save the internet with free press, et cetera. So there's been a very strong activist component to these things. When we helped out with Haiti, we also made that calculated decision that we didn't want to just be giving money to anywhere. We picked Partners in Health based on the advice of many people and some research to look at an organization that's been in Haiti for several decades, that has a strong anti-poverty agenda, so that they're not going to be tourists that are coming in. That's not to knock anybody else. It's just to say that we wanted to show our members while we were giving why we were giving, and that it wasn't just to save lives, but to protect lives and livelihoods in the future, and to think about things in depth.
How do you actually communicate with members? Is it all web, basically your Facebook page, people emailing you? I mean, how do you know what your members want you to do? To what degree is this just driven by the board deciding, what's best?
It's a great question, and it's actually something that we continue to wrestle with, because there's been some discussions I've had with foundations about building a sort of change.org for fan activists kind of have them create their own campaigns. At the same time, we don't want to scale up so fast that we end up losing what we have. So, but as far as how we communicate, the organization constantly is using Facebook, and that's not my personal one. That's the Harry Potter Line's Facebook, which is posted by our head volunteers in social media, as well as on Twitter, asking for feedback, asking, what would you guys like to see us do? And then we review that as a staff. We have three video bloggers that are putting out videos, one video a week from each of them, so three videos per week. We haven't done this in a little while.
What are those videos? Are the videos directly speaking to the community, or
absolutely. They're exploring multiple things, though. I mean, they can be about parallels in Harry Potter to our world. They can be about a social issue that matters to the community that we've done stuff about before. Mm-hmm. They can be about a specific TV show that has tremendous popularity in the fandom, which is something that I want to make sure we don't forget, is that Henry Jenkins discusses this. Fans are oftentimes, when you're in a fandom, which is different than, simply being a fan. It's not that different, but you're in a community then. You're not really just tied to a specific text the way most people think a fandom would be tied to. It's not just about, oh, I love Harry Potter and it's all I love. Henry Jenkins refers to this as the nomadic fan. And there are certain migratory patterns that you see within a specific fandom as to what other things that they're working to love. So it's very clear migratory patterns. The Harry Potter fandom is everywhere. So basically anything in pop culture it goes to. But when we look at the quantitative trends here, and this has been done through ethnographies by Henry's researchers at USC, it's been done by our own experience, and even just looking at each other, it's pretty clear that The Hunger Games, Doctor Who, anything by the author John Green, as well as he and his brother Hank have a YouTube following called the Nerdfighters, anything by Joss Whedon, these are the main things I'd say. There's a couple others that rank as big as that. Twilight, I wouldn't mention in that. That's not one of the main migratory patterns here. The TV show Sherlock, which has the same executive producer as Doctor Who. And so our vloggers talk about these shows, and we get feedback on what people think, and they talk about how these shows affect their lives, different themes in them, the personal themes as well as the global political themes. And there's a real discussion going on there. And one of our vloggers, she's just graduating from NYU and just continues to put out some incredible video blogs, which gets into the theory of the internet as a form of global folk culture, Multiple professors continue to be watching her stuff and giving us information as to what they think and how they're learning from her. She's definitely a prodigy with this stuff. And what was that?
Who is she?
Oh, her name's Lauren Bird. She's definitely somebody to be looking out for, I would say.
Okay.
To anyone. And but beyond Lauren, we also have a video blogger who, in the coming days, and I'd ask, I mean, I don't think that people, there's going to be too many people from our community on here, he will be coming out of the closet as an undocumented immigrant. And we're working with Jose Antonio Vargas on that right now. We actually have a call with Jose today to go over that. We're meeting with lawyers to make sure that he's protected and to really make sure that people understand that this young man who our community has come to love, a lot of best-selling authors love him and who we work with, he has no accent. He's incredibly nerdy. He's very charming. He's 19 years old. He's undocumented. And so this is going to be tying into a much broader issue that we're doing around equality-related issues come the November election.
How much is this about youth organizing, versus a broader population? I mean, is this primarily a youth movement online?
I mean, it's pretty clear that that our average ages are between 15 and 25. However, a lot of the chapter leaders, a lot of our most active members, are in their 40s and 50s. So it definitely spans. I mean, it's one of the unique things about Harry Potter as a phenomenon is that it spans generations, and there isn't much tension between the generations at these conferences either. But in terms of the sheer numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what were you going to say?
Right. No, I would say I'm not surprised. I mean, typically you do find that the people who have the time to, and stability to be chapter organizers are often older.
Right, exactly. So a lot of community.
But it's primarily young people, obviously. And if somebody, I'm going to mention, since we're at the halfway point here, if someone... if you're listening and you would like to jump into the conversation, hit *6 and I'll pull you into our live chat here. You can also use PD+ if you want to just tweet at us using that hashtag. So while we wait to see if somebody has a question, in the meantime, I would just say how if somebody wants to inject an idea into the Harry Potter Alliance, let's say someone's listening and they're saying, my homeless shelter needs support, or, I've got a cause that I'm trying to rally people around. It's perfect for this. How do they do that? How do ideas bubble up onto your radar?
Well, I mean, one of the most easy ways is just emailing us, which is such a boring answer to say, but that is true. It is looked at as info@thehpalliance.org. The URL is HP as in Harry Potter Alliance.org. You can certainly post on our Facebook wall, which is obviously more public, which I would encourage people to do because, it's sort of a weird thing to, to write an info account. It's always just private, but we absolutely read it and we discuss it and go over those types of things. When it comes to something like a homeless shelter, though, that is so local, we would ask them to start a chapter. They would go through the process of starting a chapter, and then if it became particularly exciting what they were doing, our chapter coordinator would alert us on that, and we would be featuring it on our blog more, interviewing them on a live webcast. We find a live webcast to be an incredible way to mobilize people on the internet. It creates one space. We refer to it as the cyber room of requirement, which is where Harry and the rest of Dumbledore's army used to meet. It's in the room of requirement. So a lot of these nuts and bolts as to how we win on campaigns is done through a kind of integrated use of social media. And so alerting us through any of our social media, we're listening. And if for some reason it falls through the cracks, finding another way, we're listening. But certainly that info@thehpalliance.org is probably the easiest way.
And is this primarily just in the U.S. or are you international?
We're international. We have more U.S. focus than any other place. And we have more people in the U.S. than any other place, but we have strong membership all over the world.
What I'd love to do is broaden out now. I know, you more recently personally got involved in trying to ride the the intense interest around the Hunger Games books, and you tried to launch something called Not the Hunger Games or Hunger Isn't a Game, right?
Hunger is not a game.
Hunger is not a game. So talk to us a little bit about that effort. How much of that is just is that an extension of the Harry Potter Alliance? Is that a completely new thing? Is there a fandom around the Hunger Games that you think has a political potential? What are you finding?
Well, The Hunger Games is a more overtly political book than Harry Potter. Have you read the books?
I have, and they're much darker, and that's saying a lot given how dark the Harry Potter books eventually get.
Yeah, this is real dystopian literature without, and it really takes the gloves off in a pretty brutal way as they continue. We really struggled to find, because I was really working to find parallels. I kept asking people, what are the parallels that you're interested in the Hunger Games? And people gave so many things. It is a harder one to work on because it's so much more real feeling. You know, there aren't wands, there are actual AK-47s. You can't work with that. You know, there is symbolism around a lot of things, including just the fact that the institution of hunger and poverty in our world acts very similarly to how the capital acts towards the districts in the Hunger Games. So we decided to go with that. It was the easiest and most obvious way to do it. We started courting the Hunger Games fandom. So there is a separate fandom, to answer your question there, from Harry Potter that is Hunger Games fans. They are hardworking. They're just like the Harry Potter fandom in that they're putting out really creative and interesting podcasts and live webcasts, and there's even music like Wizard Rock. I happen to have coined the term. It's called Rocking Jay instead of Mocking Jay. But one of the things, though, that I'll add is that they're still in the early stages of their fandom. And unlike Harry Potter, they don't have the momentum of waiting for each book to come out. They do have the momentum of waiting for each movie to come out, but they already know what the story is. So a lot of that early stuff with Harry Potter, where people were speculating what the next thing was going to be in the story, just simply can't happen. There's not enough room. That said, one of the things, and you could almost call the Harry Potter fandom the Walmart of fandom, in a sense, because we're so big at this point, and we have to be careful because we want to respect people in their local fan communities, so these localized Hunger Games fan sites. At the same time, the biggest Harry Potter fan sites, like Leaky, is moving to become a one-stop shop shopping site for all of your fandom news that you're interested in. It's already got a huge amount of people, and so it is leading the way with Hunger Games fandom stuff as well. A lot of the Wizard Rockers have changed the names of their bands and are now singing about not only Harry Potter, but Doctor Who, the Hunger Games, other things like that. So we're really seeing a change here where it's not only that the Harry Potter fandom redefined what fandom is, and it's not simply the kind of stereotypes that people think of when they think of the Star Wars, Star Trek fandom, who has elements of that, but what it's redefined as is that we're seeing a really robust conversion now to nomadic fandom, really, really seeing that, people did come together for their love of Harry Potter, and they're staying for their love of the community, but they're even staying more so for their love of other stories along with Harry Potter, and it's a really exciting moment. So we're part of that sort of nomadic movement, and we're creating a fan activist network. And that's under the auspices of a project that we're doing that eventually will turn into the umbrella organization. We're just not there yet. It's called Imagine Better. It comes from a quote from J.K. Rowling: "We do not need magic to transform the world. We carry all the power we need inside of us already. We have the power to imagine better." And the first project of Imagine Better was to do something outside of Harry Potter, which was the Hunger Games. So the Hunger Is Not a Game is the first time we've ever done something outside of Harry Potter. It's just the beginning. And it was a really, really big, big successful effort. We worked with Oxfam America. We got thousands of people on board with Oxfam's Grow initiative. Their Grow campaign is a really robust attempt at eliminating the causes of poverty through advocacy. And we're just getting started with that now. We did run into some problems, though.
You ran into a big fight with the studio, right?
Yes, that's right.
Using the words Hunger Games. though that was kind of useful in a way, because it gave you a focal point for a big campaign on change.org, right?
Yep. That, you know, the same day that they sent us the cease and desist, essentially, we got it out to the press, and I woke up the next day, and the whole internet was just hopping and excited to, well, angry, upset that a studio would get in the way of fans. And it was very condescending. You know, I've since looked back, and I can see actually where they were coming from. They gave a very genuine apology, and I really hope that we work together in the future. But Change.org contacted us, and we've already had a good relationship with them in the past. But they endorsed this campaign, and I think this was the fastest win they've ever had out of a campaign that they've ever endorsed. Probably too fast, actually, because Change.org wants to build a list. This was over in a few hours. LA Times was reporting that it was over, but just a few hours later. But by the end of the whole thing, Judd Apatow was tweeting about it. All of these people all over the world were talking about fan activism who had never heard of fan activism. The tension with Lionsgate was certainly to our advantage, and I really appreciate that they came to their senses really fast and decided not to fight fans in working with Oxfam.
I'm going to pause again and just remind folks who are listening, if you do want to ask a question, now's your chance. Hit *6 on your phones, and I'll pull you into the conversation. We have about 15 minutes left. Andrew, you have this notion of cultural acupuncture, which I think is, there's a lot of deep thinking that's gone into that crystallization. And I wonder if you might talk with us a little bit about, to what degree you think the web enables, it allows us to come together in real time as somewhat of a conscious collective, in ways that we had before, but they weren't nearly as visible. Like, for example, I'll give you an example of what I mean. There have always been surprising cultural hits, right? A song just sweeps through, American Pie, for example, right? Bye Bye American Pie. There's this, what is it, like a 9-minute-long song? You'd never commercially think that song was going to do well, and yet it strikes a chord, and suddenly everybody's singing it and, talking about it. We don't need the web to have these moments of sort of cultural coming together, but obviously now with, literally tens of millions of people hooked into all these live platforms for sharing what they're thinking and feeling and paying attention to in real time, all of this becomes easier.
Absolutely.
And you've watched that, you've participated in that, as it's matured. Do you think there's something else that's required, which is a sense of either urgency or hope or anger? I mean, how do those things affect the potential here, to sort of move people from being fans into being activists? Because, I'm sure that some people who are listening, and I do see I have a person who wants to jump in, so I'm going to bring them in a second. But, there's a flip side to this, which is that a lot of people go into things like fiction because it's an escape. In other words, the real world is too depressing, it's overwhelming. You can't make change that, really changes reality. And we all have made fun of, Star Trek fans, right? Get a life, as William Shatner famously once said.
Right.
So, so how much of this is you're buffeted by, the real world and fiction in some ways is an escape. Here you are trying to get people to, instead of escape, go out into the world and make meaningful change happen, right? I mean, aren't we facing a little bit of a paradox? We're facing a feedback loop. Let's hear it. We've got somebody on the line.
Sure.
If you would just tell us your name and where you're from, and go ahead and make your comment.
Hey, it's Mike Tick, Strong Economy for All Coalition in New York. It's a really good conversation so far. Thanks, Andrew and Mika. I wanted to ask, you know, it's pretty clear that with Harry Potter and with the other, you know, kind of exploding young adult fiction, your participants are kind of ripping off of narratives that were developed by writers, by film and TV auteurs. And I was wondering if, you know, in addition to mobilizing this type of activism, whether you think there are any sort of themes, emotional connections, methods that these writers and auteurs use in their kind of cultural production that undergird the sort of your ability to sort of get a lot of people together and rip off of it, right? We've got these communities, they all respond to things, and particularly in whether there might be lessons for other activist groups that are doing campaigns that may or may not have natural connections to young adult fiction or to sort of other popular cultural things. Are there things in these narratives that help make it more likely that good activism will happen?
Oh, great question.
That's a really wonderful question. Yeah. So both of your questions, Mike, so thank you, Mike. Both of your questions here kind of tie together with looking at anything by Carl Jung, but more specifically Joseph Campbell. You know, if you look at, if you go to most schools, most people in D.C., none of these people in D.C. or, you know, in the business world outside of marketing understand much about Joseph Campbell. If you go to Hollywood or people are writing the most successful screenplays, everybody knows who Joseph Campbell is. These authors are looking at Joseph Campbell. You know, George Lucas talked about, he credited Joseph Campbell with his work. If you want a quick, an easy way to get Joseph Campbell and to understand what he's doing, you should go to your library or rent, and, you know, I guess somewhere on Netflix, The Power of Myth series with Joseph Campbell and Bill Moyers. He was a famous mythologist who really broke down mythology and gave it a really useful interpretation of modern mythology. But a lot of Campbell's, his steps in the journey of the hero are very clear in how a hero's journey is told. And it's told that way in every culture, in some manner, and the best stories are the ones that resonate with the algorithm of the journey of the hero that he created, the 12 stages of that hero's journey. Now, when we look at something like the Obama campaign, we see Obama as a hero in 2008. Now, I don't know if he's going for that same impression right now, but to speak to that narrative, you know, you have a politician that comes and has this incredible story, and somehow that story hits the American story, the story of the global citizen that's emerging. Micha, to hit to your point, we have been practicing mythology, telling mythology, you know, since before there was an internet, since before there was most technology that we use today, before there was a Western civilization. Mythology has always been this kind of feedback loop of going into an escape and then coming back out richer for it. You know, the Harry Potter Alliance, the work we're doing is with modern mythology. We're in no ways a religion, but certainly you can find people in religions who go to escape. But then they come out, they find a community of people who love a shared story, whether it's in Judeo-Christian stories or in other stories around the world, and they end up as a community working on a variety of social issues. Normally their work is much more powerful, it's much more fun, it's much more interesting than the work of organizations that are organizing simply around values. And that's one of the problems that progressives, I'll speak to progressives, I am one, tend to run into, is stressing values over narrative. It's losing a sort of way to emote and a way that we connect as human beings through the most basic thing that we've always been doing, which is storytelling. It's the most basic thing that babies do. The storytelling, Obama recently admitted that his one of his biggest failures, if not the biggest, was not acknowledging that the president's office is storyteller-in-chief, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we're doing, yes, people do go into Harry Potter to escape, for sure, and their community is about escaping, but then they want something to do with it. Not everybody, for sure, but what we have found is if you stay committed to that story and at the same time to the world, turns out they don't really want to escape from the world. They just want to go through, I refer to it as a metaphysical mirror. Myth is a mirror to our experience and always has been. It's metaphysical because we can actually walk into the mirror and escape into another world on the other side of the mirror and come back differently. We do it as a community. We can work together to change the world. But there are certain tropes, Mike, to speak to your question, around the hero's journey. I urge you to look at with Joseph Campbell that Rowling is so clear in Suzanne Collins, certainly so clear in Chris Nolan with Batman. Batman Begins is about Joseph Campbell in its pure form. That's the best answer I can give in our limited time.
I can't resist asking you this. But at the risk of venturing into a not safe for work conversation, what in your view is going on with the 50 Shades of Grey book phenomenon? You could take a pass if you would prefer.
I'm not an expert on 50 Shades of Grey. Haven't read it yet, and I don't think I will.
Not really aimed at you.
Yeah, it's not aimed at me. It was originally Twilight fan fiction, I think to understand what's going on with 50 Shades of Grey, you really need to get into the Twilight and vampire mythology as it exists in our world. Really look at why True Blood and Twilight and the Vampire Diaries were all huge at the same exact time.
Right.
And there's a whole analysis there that I can give as to why I think the vampire myth resurged at the time that it did. But that would require lengthy discussion. But yeah, what 50 Shades of Grey is tapping into, though, is it's actually really exciting in some ways because, you have a fan fiction author who then, walked away from her fan fiction and created her own universe. Apparently, it's not the greatest writing, but it's certainly borrowing on some old tropes, ancient tropes, to get people
one
tied in.
One out of five books being sold today is one of those three.
Says something.
That does say something. I haven't gone very far into exploring it, but I think that what's really helpful and fascinating about talking to you is realizing that. The world of politics and political activism, taps into these deep wells what inspires people, what keeps you going, and that we shouldn't laugh at the possibility that, those deeper wells, which for many people are religion, and for other people, they're inspiring stories that as you alluded to, like the grand narrative of the civil rights movement, which I think still resonates for many, many people. And in other cases, it can be these new kinds of compelling social movements, young people growing up on a story like Harry Potter. With just a few minutes left to go, Andrew, I'm wondering – if you have, bring this back to a person who is running a more conventional, advocacy organization, what would you say to people who work, say, in the environmental or healthcare or education, the kinds of bread and butter fights that lots and lots of people are engaged with? What should they be taking from the lesson of that you've learned from things like the Harry Potter Alliance and the Hunger Games kinds of activism that you've done?
Well, two things. One is an invitation. Please email me, andrew@thehpalliance.org, or I can be found at Andrew Slack on Twitter. Right now, building through Imagine Better, we're focusing on three things. One is this fan activist network. Two is we're building a new approach to education. It starts with the stories that we love, blockbuster books, movies, and TV shows. But three is what I'm referring to as the Center for Cultural Acupuncture, which is going to start as nothing more than a Google group and to begin looking at different organizations and how we can use the power of mythology and story to change the story of our world. Examples would be, if you're running a service-based organization, you need people, and it's based in New York City, and you need more people involved in that organization, can we work together to figure out how to tap into the rivalry, the story between the Red Sox fans in Boston and the Yankees fans in New York, and clock in community service hours in both cities? If one city loses that year and only 40 people participate, you best believe the media in Boston, if we lose, will be pushing everybody to fight back their volunteering the next year, because it's humiliating. And it's borrowing on that story. Another example, if you're doing media reform work, I am very interested, and I'm doing a lot of writing on this right now, to create a populist mythology of the internet. And we still don't have any story as to what's actually going on here in our world that is unprecedented, that we're seeing nonlinear thinking and organizing happening in a way that we've never seen it before, never like this. And it's unprecedented and exciting. If you're doing stuff on environmental stuff, I'm working with a friend right now developing plans and thinking about these kinds of things. Global warming is to quote a blogger I was reading last week, public policy nightmare. We have, is it silent? Yes. Is it over a long stretch of time? Yes. Does it require international cooperation from bureaucratic nations and companies? Yes. Who are generally risk averse? Yes. All of these things. How do we change that? Well, we have to give it a face, give it a story, have global warming become a supervillain. So we want to do an animated series of videos with creating the Dark Lord Terracide. Instead of a little dog or cat that he's stroking the decapitated head of a polar bear. He has assistants like Captain Cole and the Fossil Fools, and he's basically telling you that he's going to be drowning your grandchildren, and it's not a matter of if he wins, but when, so you may as well join him. And then we have a community of people that are fighting back through volunteering at concerts we hook up with, and have his face plastered everywhere with a Ghostbusters X, and an actionable step taken at those concerts to text messaging all at the same time. We have this community-wide story of heroes. I think even though if your organization is working on something smaller than global warming or on something local, still always important, I think, to tap into those bigger stories so that people feel like they're part of something bigger.
That's great advice. And it's really fascinating, and we will absolutely continue to check in with you and cover the work that you and your whole network are involved in over on techpresident.com. Again, Andrew Slack of the Harry Potter Alliance, the HPAlliance.org on the web. Thank you so much for your time. We've really appreciated it. For everybody else who's listening, we'll see you online.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you. This was awesome.